Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1092. Head on over to ID10T.com and see what's new in the shop. Lots of fun stuff, putting up more stuff every damn week. So go please check it out. But enough about our stuff. Let's talk about you, the ID10T community. Events at ID10T.com to get on the corkboard, like Jay Gonzo, who writes, I spent most of the last decade writing, drawing, designing, and publishing my own comic book series, La Mano del Destino, an epic tale of lucha libre set in an alternate universe, 1960s Mexico, that is drawn, colored, and produced to look like a vintage comic book. After all this time, it is finally time to collect the series into a trade paperback, as I had originally wanted to additionally publish each issue in Spanish as they came out, but couldn't afford to as I was self-financing. The collected edition will be both in English and Spanish as a flipbook. One half has the entire story in English, flip it over, and the other half has the entire story in Spanish. I am kickstarting the trade paperback so that I can connect directly with the woefully underserved Latinx comic book community and bring them an exciting and authentic representation of our culture. The Kickstarter can be found by searching La Mano del Destino on the Kickstarter site. Thank you, Jay Gonzo. Amazing work all this time and commitment putting out your comic. And what an amazing idea to create a multilingual flipbook. That it's genius. So thank you so much for sharing. To anyone else, events at ID10T.com to get your thing mentioned on the corkboard. This episode is Aaron Moriarty, who is on The Boys, which is an incredible show. If you're not watching it, it's amazing. My wife and I love it. Season 2 is going on right now. It's on Amazon Prime. You can watch it. You should watch it. It's really great. From the mind of Eric Kripke, who created Supernatural, The Boys is just a superb show. Everyone on the show is great. Aaron plays Starlight, aka Annie, and she is fantastic on the show. And this was such a fun conversation. It's so fun to have guests on and discover that they're really into philosophy. So we kind of dovetailed into this great conversation about mindfulness and existentialism and meaning and all this wonderful stuff. But just a really, really, really fun chat. So much appreciation and respect to Aaron Moriarty for being a phenomenal actor and for also being a brilliantly philosophical and incredibly nice human being. So here you go. This is the ID10T podcast number 1092 with the fantastic Aaron Moriarty.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you doing?
God, you have a much better lighting setup, and I've been doing this for so long, and I have literally the worst lighting setup you can have.
Well, you're backlit.
That's the
problem.
You're
backlit, that's why. But yeah, you know what? I can still see you. Like, I played around with it before because I'm in front of a window right now.
Yeah.
But I've been doing so many Zoom meetings lately, and I've just been playing with my camera and its position because this is now the world that we're in and how we need to adjust. But I can still see you. It's not as bad as some of the Zoom meetings I've been doing.
If I lean back, I'm in utter darkness. So I have to awkwardly lean forward to some of the light. I've experimented with there's a wall here. I've experimented with putting light like a weird vampire because I'm just like totally watching.
Yeah.
I think I got to move this.
I don't know. I think people are forgiving right now. Do you know what I mean? I feel like they're more forgiving than they usually are in terms of quality because everyone is just doing their best at the moment.
You're absolutely right. It's the little things that we get hung up on are like, no one cares what your lighting setup is.
If they do, they're caring about the wrong things, you know?
Yeah, or there is that also, sometimes people can go into like this veil of denial because they don't want to think about the big ticket items, and so they just focus on really stupid things, like, my sandwich is cold, like, okay, maybe you're being distracted
Yes.
Because you cannot deal with everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So let me just first of all say, just because it's an audio podcast, your home is gorgeous. I see like a Spanish style, maybe late 1920s style Spanish, which is our house, even though you can't tell from this room.
Mm, yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think my building was built in the my building was built in the 1920s, and it's Spanish style, and I love them. Like, I'm originally from New York City, and when I came out to LA, all of the architecture that appealed to me most was the Spanish style houses and the buildings, and I just find them to be the most beautiful. And the last time I was looking for a condo, I looked at so many boxy ones that were modern and really nice, but they felt more like bachelor pads. They were a bit sterile. And then I walked into this place and it just had character. And I'm just really into anywhere that's got a bit of history and you can see it in the aesthetics, you know what I mean? And then you update it and customize it to your own liking. But I love old architecture and old places.
Yeah, and in LA, this is about there is a stratum of Los Angeles that dates back to the late 1800s, but it's very small, and you really have to search for it. So a lot of LA architecture history really kind of starts in the 20s when it starts booming with the film industry and people start moving out to Los Angeles. So for us to be Los Angelinos, it's like, yeah, this is our history. But to any other part of the country saying like, my building is so old, it was built in like 28. They're like,
I know.
This is our history. So it's gorgeous. It's just a gorgeous place.
Yeah.
Do you watch a lot of renovation shows?
Okay. So, you know, I feel like if I got into them, I would love them. The reason why I'm obsessed with architecture and interior design, because my mom works in interior design, and growing up, we're from New York City, and I grew up predominantly in this like big pre-war quintessential like Upper West Side apartment. And the way her style was beautiful and impeccable. Mm-hmm. And I try and kind of emulate her to the degree that I can, but she instilled in me this kind of obsession with interior design. And I also just feel like, as an actor, you know, we have a lot of periods, extended periods of dormant time. So a house to me is something that just, you can always have a project going on and a way to upgrade it and make it more yours. And so I would say for me, interior design has always played a role in my life and heart the way fashion does for some women, you know?
Right. Yeah. It reminds me just sort of, I mean, not to be weird about the stuff in your background, but my wife and I, we like to restore houses. And so we're very much into sort of like interior design, architecture, and we watch a lot of shows. And so what I love about how your place is appointed is that it looks like, my wife has this theory that you don't try to necessarily put into a place what the building isn't exactly asking for. You kind of pick pieces that speak to you, and you are kind of the story that helps tie it all together. So there's this really great industrial wall lamp in the background, and it looks like, trying to see if that's like a little mid-century piece, but then this really great rug that, and so everything really talks to each other in a really great way, which is, I imagine, expressive of who you are as an artist.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also such a homebody. Like, ironically, despite my job, I'm pretty introverted. And so for me, building a home that was reflective of myself, that I feel totally comfortable in, was really important. Because also, you know, you travel a lot for acting, and I'm gone customarily like half of the year. And so this was the first place that I owned, and I owned it as of a couple of years ago. And it was the first place that really felt entirely my own. Right. And so it was the first time that I felt like I had full creative license to just do with it what I wanted. And so, I don't know, I just really, just like you said, it felt like, since I am a homebody, the perfect opportunity to kind of cultivate a space that's reflective of you, but that you feel totally comfortable in, and that's aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah,
you know.
Is this your first home? Is this your first? This your first one?
First one.
So what advice do you have for people who are maybe home right now and experiencing their home more than just a place to sleep and eat and shower up? That are saying, you know, like, I want to figure out who I am and how to express myself and with interior design. Like, what are some tips that you would give to people?
Honestly, like, one of the things that was really helpful to me, and this is pretty nerdy when it comes to interior design. I think it's a level of effort that maybe not a lot of people would consider putting in, but it pays off. Is like, I have a gallery wall and it has a lot of artwork on it, and it literally made like a Word document with screenshots of the photos and artwork, and arranged it on the document to see how it would look all together. You know what I mean? To see how it would look all together according to the dimensions. But I would say, like, boards, like Pinterest is so popular, right? And you can, I would say one of the benefits of like Instagram and Pinterest is I'll save things that inspire me for style or home, especially Pinterest. And when I was decorating my apartment, I made a mood board for my apartment, and it was so, like, I would see so many pieces of furniture, or like my dining room area was totally inspired by one photograph I saw on Pinterest. Do you know what I mean? And I love a mix of things, but I love kind of Scandinavian furniture and mid-century design mixed with like eclectic vintage. And so I would just search for that. And I kind of just copied a bunch of things and combined a bunch of things. So my home is really derivative, but I would say like visual representations of what you would want, and then just going out and trying to find them. And if you're on a budget, honestly, there are so many websites and furniture stores right now that are not super expensive. And if you're building a home and you want to upgrade it a little bit, and you have a good eye and you just are committed to the search, you can find really cute things on a budget.
Yeah.
As well. Which,
you know, I've had this conversation with a lot of people about how we love almost everything in our house is either antique or salvage or upcycled. And it's just the word got out on that a handful of years ago. And now stuff that it's like the markup is getting crazy.
Oh my God, like, it's insane.
It's like 400% of what it was like 5 or 6 years ago. You're like, it's a cool old window, but it's just an old, you know, like, let's not get.
Really? Exactly.
$1,800, really?
I know.
Do you have go-to sites that you like to find bits and bobs of things?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I've done a lot of, I have done quite a bit of restoration hardware. I've done a little bit of West Elm. I've done, in terms of vintage, like, there's this vintage rug site that I think has the most beautiful rugs I've ever seen called Woven Abode. And I love rugs. Like, to me, I love them. And then I'm trying to think of what else. I mean, Room and Board has really good stuff. Lulu in Georgia has really good stuff. Like, they, and then also, but to be honest, like, you can go on, like, you can buy little things from, like, first of all, CB2 rocks. CB2 has awesome items.
CB2 is great. Yeah.
CB2 is great, but then you can go to, like, you can go to Target and you can go to IKEA, and then you can fill in the missing pieces with some really good stuff from them that's really inexpensive. You know what I mean? So I think if you have enough nice pieces that you've maybe found that are, I don't know if refined is the right word, but just like well-made, and you mix it, balance it with stuff that's more budgeted, like from Target and IKEA, I think you can make a beautiful home.
Yeah.
I mean, IKEA has great stuff. You know what I mean? So for me, it was like a few, like, the non-negotiable for me was my vintage rug, but then I was totally like, my bed frame, which is beautiful, is from Urban Outfitters and it's not expensive. You know what I mean? So it's a mix of things and deciding where you want to spend your money and where, you know, and then hopefully you can just have a good eye and like kind of go on websites you wouldn't expect, and you could find things that are really nice, you know?
Yeah, I found there's a really good, I've gotten a few cool rugs on this site called killim.com, K-I-L-I-M.
Oh yeah, I feel like I've heard of that.
I mean, I got this great antique 10 and a half foot runner for like, I don't know, it was like $600 or something. And
Yeah.
if you saw that on Melrose or at one of the, it would be like $3,000 or $4,000.
Thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, this vintage rug was really expensive from a website that has beautiful rugs. But then the runner in my hallway is from Etsy and it was nothing. And people see both of them and they assume they're kind of the same quality. You know what I mean? So it's a balance, it's a mix and match. But I don't know. It was so fun to decorate it. But of course, I've been sitting in my apartment in quarantine, having decorated my apartment like a year and a half ago. And I'm really happy with the way it's decorated, but I'm bored of my environment. And so, of course, like my idea is to redecorate, but I know it's unnecessary and I'll regret it. You know what I mean? I just want change. You know what I mean? I want to be on the move. And so it's just funny the way that like I think we're forced to be so still right now. And it's funny how I don't know what the anxiety of that can manifest. You know, like I would love to redecorate the home that I've worked so hard on and I love the decorations for, but I still want to refurnish it.
Well, yeah, especially because so many of us are so used to, if that makes sense, we live through doing rather than living through being, right? So it's very difficult to sit still. And when you don't have anything to do, you start feeling like, do I even exist? Because do I exist if I'm not doing something?
I
And
know.
so it feels like one of the great lessons of this, and there are many, one of them is like, how do we sit with ourselves and how do we be okay just being and not having to like, I gotta do shit, you know? Like, how do we do that?
Yeah, I would say for me, from the beginning, that's been the most confronting thing because this all started, and in the beginning, like a lot of other people, you know, I leaned into it and I embraced the stillness of it, but that became old kind of quickly, and it was really confronting for me to realize how much I define myself in what am I doing? What's the level of my productivity instead of just being? And I feel like when you're doing, you're often relying on so many external factors to validate you. And I wasn't aware of how much I was doing that. And then this all went down, and you know, like the entertainment industry, it really shut down to a certain extent. And there were certain things still happening, but I've never been more still. And the things that came up in terms of like confronting yourself, how much do I rely on these external forces to define myself? How much do I wrap my identity around doing and being productive instead of just being able to be? And I just think that that has been a universal issue for myself and a lot of people I know, but it's a luxury issue to contemplate because when you consider the state of the world right now and how people are being affected, do you know what I mean? Just the mere ability to ruminate over things and get introspective, I recognize the privilege of that,
Understood. Yes,
but it's definitely been confronting in that sense.
my wife and I, our favorite show of the past year, was The Boys. And yeah, I feel like two of
Was
our big shows were What We Do in the Shadows
it?
and The Boys, and you know, Rick and Morty, and then some good a bunch of design and investigation discovery shows. But I've known Eric Kripke for 25 years. When
No way.
we were basically kids, I was in this low budget movie and he was the first AD, and we've been friends since like 1994.
Wow.
And then, and now like watching, like, oh, Eric is one of the most accomplished showrunner
Showrunner.
creators in television. It's so wonderful because I've just, yeah, I love the guy. I've just known him for so long.
He's such a good dude, and it's so funny though, because he'll tell us this story about how he's told me this more than once about how he once got hired like years and years ago to be a first AD on a job, and he had no idea what the fuck he was doing. So I wonder if that was
I'm sure that was it. I'm sure that was it.
He talks about it to this day.
Yeah, I had lunch with him about, I don't know, a handful of months before quarantine, maybe the end of last year, beginning of this year. And it was just so funny to sort of like how did we get here? Like, you know, how, where did time go? You know, it was just one of those things. But he's, I have a tremendous amount of respect for him because he said something that I've not heard often in this business, which is, rather than like try to build an empire where he's overseeing a bunch of, he goes, you know what? I just like the intimacy of focusing on one show. It allows me to have balance with my family. I get to hang out with my kids. I don't have to stress. And I was like, that is an incredibly enlightened and very mentally healthy approach for a business that is not common in.
Yeah. And I, listen, the actors on The Boys reap the benefits of that because I don't know, this might just be a personal projection because I'm actually not very good at multitasking, but I think you can multitask to a certain degree before you're just overextended, right? So I feel like we really benefit from The Boys being his primary, you know, exertion of creative energy. Because our show has so much going on in it. It's so, like, I, to be honest, after shooting season two, which had so much going on and I've watched all of it, I kind of forget some of what happened in season one, not with my character, but other characters, and it'll be brought up to me. They're, every episode is so packed with storyline and characters, and our ensemble cast is huge that I think we would need a showrunner who is just solely dedicated to overseeing our show and who is allowing it to be his or her primary focus. So I think we reap the benefits of that. And the nice thing about Eric is exactly what you said. Like, he's just so human. He's just a good dude. You know what I mean? Like, he adores his family, and his family is a priority, and we're all aware of that. You know what I mean? And showrunners are often pretty, I mean, it's a hard job and they're pretty overworked, but he's always made it clear that, like, you know, the first year we went to New York Comic Con, he was staying in New York for an extra 24 hours to go to a family member's bat mitzvah in New Jersey. And that's just what he'll do. Do you know, like, he's just a good first and foremost human being. And so to have him as our boss, it sets the tone of the set when the top of the chain is like that.
Yeah.
And he's got a no asshole policy because he's so grounded and down to earth. And it's the first set I've ever worked on where a boss has said that, and it's actually been true to.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. So he's a great dude to work for. We call him our set dad because he just kind of has that presence.
Yeah. And he's really funny too. He's just a funny, funny, warm guy. But sort of what you were saying about him just focusing on this one show, it sort of makes me think about your design philosophy where when you have the ability to focus on details and really think everything through, The Boys really is a show of moments that, I want to be careful because I don't want to spoil anything. So I don't want to talk about specific story points because if someone's listening, I don't want them to go, oh shit, I'm not caught up. And anyone should go watch the show immediately. But in the first episode, something very dramatic happens like right away with Jack Quaid's character that you're like, oh fuck. And it, and it really sets the tone. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of that experience of watching Breaking Bad where you watch the show and all of a sudden you're like, what the fuck just happened?
Totally.
And you have to like hold the hand of the person next to you because you can't stressful and amazing and crazy. And The Boys has that, all the way throughout the series nonstop.
Oh yeah. No, we definitely have shock. We're not subtle with our shock value and how it's kind of present every single episode. But yeah, I mean, I like that because, you know, we have so much content that's out on Netflix and Amazon Prime and so many TV shows, and they're all so good that I can get overwhelmed sometimes. So when I choose a show to watch, like Breaking Bad, which is still to this day, like one of my number ones, and a show has that beginning surprise element to it.
Yeah.
I just love it because I know I'm in for something that maybe I haven't seen before. And we've just seen so much at this point. So that's why when I read the pilot script for The Boys, you know, it's like, you never, part of the fallacy of being an actor, you just don't, you have no control over the end product. You have no idea how it's going to turn out. If the script is brilliant, you still don't know if it's going to be executed properly. Right. It's a good and a bad thing, because if it turns out poorly, it's not entirely your fault, hopefully. Right. But if it turns out, you know, if it turns out brilliantly, it's like, it's great. And it's sometimes a pleasant surprise, because the amount of times something turns out as well as you'd hope is less than people think who are outside of the industry, I think. So I read the first pilot of The Boys and I thought, no matter what happens with this show, it's going to be so fun to film and it's going to be fucking bold. Like, you know what I mean? I have never within the first three scripts of a season of a show read, and this is like a tiny spoiler, but not as big as the one about Jack Quaid and what he goes through, but with Fatal Cunnilingus, where this girl is sitting on this guy's face and she squishes him to death. You know what I mean? And I was like, bare minimum, it's just going to be.
Great name for a band, by the way. That is a great name for a band.
Fatal Cunnilingus.
Fatal performing at Spaceland.
Yeah. I was like, I just don't, like, I don't even care. And then it was just, it was great that people, it was received well and people liked it. But I was like, this show is so fun to do. I just kind of, I let go and I was like, I don't even care at this point. This is so wild. And every episode holds so much, I don't know, there's so much surprise and shock that it's just like, to see what comes out of Eric Kripke's brain is a delight, and to happen to be able to act in it is just fun, you know?
Yeah. And again, without going too much into detail, the show really does a good job of being a pretty interesting, great commentary on our obsession with social media culture and our obsession with celebrity and what that means. The show is just a really fun ride, and I really hope it goes on for a lot of seasons. You're great in the show, and it really is just, I didn't know what to expect. I just knew Eric had done the show, and I said to my wife, like, oh, my friend Eric, he created Supernatural, he's got this new show. There was signage for it all over Comic-Con last year.
Yeah.
And within 5 minutes we were like, Jesus Christ, this is amazing. and we binged, like, we watched them all immediately.
So, yeah.
Because also, if you're lucky enough to work for a long time, sometimes, like you said, you work on things you can't control the outcome. And
yes.
Oh, what are you working on? Oh, I'm working on this thing, but I don't know if it's something. But to work on something that you're proud of and you can't wait to talk about is a real gift in this business.
Yeah, it is. And then for it to be an ongoing thing, you know what I mean? Because prior to this, I'd done a little television, but mostly mostly movies and mostly indies. So they were short, really short shoots. You know, you invest yourself in them for a very small, finite amount of time, and then you let it go. If they do well, great. If they don't, you know, it is what it is. It teaches you to kind of just be present with the shooting experience. But for this to kind of catalyze any excitement and positivity in the reception, and then be able to go back to work is just an unprecedented experience for me. And it's just, it's very cool. And it incentivizes all of us to go back and like, you know, with season two, which there can be pressure with, it's like the difficult second album. Right. And I think Eric felt that, and we all felt that. And with season two, I think Eric was just incentivized to top his game. And I think he did do that, you know, I think, luckily. So, but it's just cool. It just motivates you to go back to work and like keep working hard on all of our characters and add to their nuances with each season as we're able to live in their shoes a little bit more and be able to take their history into account because we've played it on screen. And and the people on that set are really wonderful people. So it's just been overall a really unprecedented experience for me. And the ride so far has been really great. And, you know, it's, I feel like an audience member when I get each script, and each script has just the craziest shit in it. Every script has like a shock value moment. And it's just fun, you know, whether I get to be in it or I get to observe my coworkers doing it. It's just like, I have had many moments when I've looked over to my coworkers on set and we're like, I cannot believe that this is our job. Like, we get paid for this, you know?
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's so interesting because it is about superheroes, but it's also not at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the superhero part is almost incidental to the mm-hmm. sort of commentary of the show. And whereas a traditional superhero show, like the powers are sort of demonstrative. It's like, oh, look, you know, Superman mm-hmm. can shoot laser, you know, he can do that. But with this, the mm-hmm. powers create this complex level of added responsibility to the character mm-hmm. and also add to the shock value. Like, they drive the momentum of the story at the same mm-hmm. time in a way that's really unique. I mean, the show is really a triumph. Do you, when you went to Comic-Con last year, mm-hmm. had the show aired yet, or was it about to air?
So it hadn't aired yet. It was literally about to air. It was a really fun experience, but simultaneously, and we were also shooting season two at the time, right? We had gone and picked up for season two prior to season one's release. So Comic-Con was really fun. I think because it was a graphic novel before it was a show, we already had a pre-established fan base. So we went there and there was already a level of enthusiasm and there were a lot of fans, but it wasn't out. So we had all the hopes in the world, but you just never know what to expect. And so I remember being there and it was really celebratory. It was really fun. We were all soaking it up, but the show wasn't coming out for about a week.
Okay.
And we were in the middle of shooting season two and I just thought, God, maybe just because quality doesn't always correlate with success. And I believed in the quality of our show, but it's really like, it pushes the envelope. It's a little bit, you know, it's very irreverent. So I didn't know if that would translate to it being received well. But I remember being at Comic-Con and thinking, this is so fun. This is either going to be like the kickoff to a really awesome ride, or it's going to be the moment where we just all have to soak this up and our time here together and be grateful that we even have this experience, you know, because I also was thinking, well, if the show comes out and we're in the middle of filming season two, and it's not received well, the rest of filming season two is going to be the most awkward, weird experience in the world. And then it came out and then it did well. And it was, the rest of season two was awesome. And it was overwhelming because we were going to set every day in Toronto and we were all together when it came out and did well. So that was really fun. But Comic-Con was a really fun experience, but also I just did not, I'm so suspicious of the, of being, I don't know, of the potential success of something. I think you're conditioned as an actor, if you work more and more, to just keep expectations totally at bay. So we were celebrating and we had fans there, but it wasn't out. And I couldn't get over that. I needed for it to come out and prove to me that it would do relatively well before I felt fully celebratory. But luckily that gratifying moment came. But yeah, Comic-Con was really fun. And I gotta be honest, like I'm bummed that of course we can't be there this year. It would be, it's impossible, yeah. But I missed it. I missed that experience. Like, you know, like-minded people who are just nerding out together, being in the same place and just having a blast. I really missed it.
You also would have seen a lot of Starlight cosplay too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have blown your mind because I've witnessed that before mm-hmm. when someone starts on a show and then all of a sudden it starts to tip and become a thing. And they're like, oh my God, that person's dressed, you know? And then they just love the, you know, they marvel at the detail and then watching them go up and nerd out with the fan and go, oh my God, your cosplay is amazing. It's exactly what my character is. I mean, that type of connection, it's just what Comic-Con is all about, but you know, we will get back there someday, but
it couldn't happen
this year.
Yeah.
When you're filming, mm-hmm. You sort of talk about like creating your home space. Do you have mm-hmm. a ritual or do you have some things that you bring with you to try mm-hmm. to homeify your away mm-hmm. space, or do mm-hmm. you just a temporary place to sleep?
Yeah, no, I definitely, especially because when we film in Toronto, we're we're there for about 6-7 months. So I definitely try and make it my own home space. If it were more temporary, I think I would bring things from home, but it's when I get there, I have my little things and they're really trivial, but they're the little things that like that keep me sort of grounded on a day-to-day basis. And they're kind of silly. It's like, there is a specific incense. They sell it in Toronto. I buy that. I buy the foods I love in Canada. I cook a lot at home. I buy anything that doesn't like, I buy a Chemex because most places don't have the coffee supplies that I want. But mostly for me, and it was interesting because last year I had just gotten a puppy before we went off to film season 2.
Yep.
And I was kind of terrified because when you have all the time in the world, having a puppy is great. They give you purpose. They're adorable. I mean, obviously it's hard work as well, but I had only had my puppy so far during a period of not working. So I thought this is either going to be amazing or it's going to be really difficult because our schedule is pretty intense.
Yeah.
But what I noticed when I brought my dog with me is that having a dog and traveling around with them, especially when you move to a new city for 6 months, where I was living immediately felt like home just because I had him there. It was the most grounding sort of ritual or addition I could have had in my home. And I was relieved because we have these very long days on set and I would think, oh, maybe I'm not going to want to come home and walk the dog. I just usually want to just crash. But coming home and having the dog to come home to kind of take my mind off of the day's work and shed that day of work and be able to unwind and have him make it feel like home. That to me was the most impactful. Truly.
That's great. I know we got a puppy a month before quarantine.
Oh, wow.
But he's a very large dog and he's getting uh-huh. And my favorite part of the day is my wife and I will kind of walk him just before sunset and it's mm-hmm. just so meditative and he loves mm-hmm. it. And there's so many smells for him and we're walking mm-hmm. outside together and it's, you know, it really does. It really is like soul healing to sort of feel like,
yes.
I'm breathing, I'm walking, my dog's happy, you know, it's
good. Yeah. And it simplifies things. Like I imagine it's to a very, 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 very minor degree inversion of what my friends say having a kid is like in terms of it kind of gives you perspective and makes you, it simplifies things. Like you walk outside with your dog and hopefully you can be present with that. And you just kind of like, they just kind of make you laugh and you observe the way that they look at the world and you are able to just kind of forget momentarily about what else is going on. At least that's what I kind of got a dog.
Yeah.
It's that force, like, no, you've got to take that sunset walk every day because your dog needs exercise. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a newfound sense of purpose. And I think that's just healthy to have, especially out of an animal that all it's going to do is reciprocate the love you give it. You know what I mean? All it wants is love. It's so sweet.
And also it, and much in the same way, like the comparison to having kids, at least this part is, mm-hmm. I think there's definitely the connection of, it gets you out of your head and it gets you out of focusing on yourself. And it's
yes.
so easy, not just in this business, but with our sort of social media obsessed culture.
Yes.
We're always, you know, and the news that's being delivered to us is about stuff we are,
yes.
we already like. And it's like the music, it knows we already like. So we're so much
totally.
All the time. And it's so refreshing to be like, oh yeah.
Yes.
This is another being that I need to focus on. And I'm not thinking about myself and that's good.
It's therapeutic. Like I remember for 2 years prior to me getting a dog, my therapist was like, you need to get a pet. I'm telling you, it's going to be really good for you to have another being to focus on.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's a lot of responsibility. And then I didn't really intend to get a dog. He kind of just like literally fell in my lap and I was like, okay, this is my dog. And it's true. It's that it pops that bubble that we tend to live in. I also think that like when you're an actor, you're kind of selling yourself. You are the product.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can kind of lead to a living in a chronic narcissistic bubble, which I am constantly trying to fight against. Sure. And for me, the dog thing has been pivotal in that. It's those little things that keep you grounded and not just, especially right now in quarantine too, when we're all in our spaces and in our heads a lot, and we don't have the resources we normally would to interact with other people and disconnect from ourselves in a good way. And so I think it's really beneficial to have something like a dog that you can exert that, not even exert it, but that you can use to step outside of your own mental bubble that right. is being, the thickness of which is being enhanced, I think, by quarantine and the state of the world right now.
And we briefly pause to thank the sponsor for this episode of the ID10T podcast, Squarespace. Hey, maybe you've made your thing. Maybe you're thinking about making a thing. Maybe now's the time. But if you make the thing, then you're definitely going to need some type of an internet or digital home, a presence to tell people about it, to show the world. And Squarespace is going to help you with that. Squarespace's domains, websites, online stores, marketing tools, all of it. And now email campaigns. Now, these campaigns are going to be consistent from website to email all the way through. You're going to have powerful editing tools to make it your own, customizable layouts for any kind of message and mobile editing so you can send anytime, anywhere. You don't even have to be in front of a big old fancy computer. So everything is optimized for you right out of the box. You can also buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, and then you're going to get analytics to help you grow in real time. Built-in SEO, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. So go to squarespace.com/ID10T. That's for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast, which we now rejoin. You bring up such a great point, too, about the sort of the pull of like the narcissism bubble. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, because you can be on the phone all day talking about auditions that you might have or press or, you know, and it's sort of, it does sort of encourage you to focus on yourself because as performers, mm-hmm. effectively, we are like a corporation that we're building in a way, you know, and your PR is the marketing team and your manager is the management and it can be very easy, the trapping of defining your self-worth by external mm-hmm. things that have very little to do with mm-hmm. you.
Yeah.
It sounds like you have a really healthy approach to mm-hmm. everything. So how do you maintain that? And what advice do you have for people who might be too drawn to look to external mm-hmm. events and go, oh, I am a failure because this external thing, mm-hmm. like if the boys hadn't done well, mm-hmm. you know, but of course it did, mm-hmm. but if it hadn't, like, how do you not internalize that and go, oh, mm-hmm. now I feel bad about me, even though this has very little to do with me?
Mm. Well, first of all, I did make all the mistakes early on. And I think that, like, I think it can be really hard to get into acting really young because it's such an adult business. And sometimes your growth and your maturation process can be almost too accelerated. Mm-hmm. But one of the benefits of starting young, because my first job was when I was 15, but I really didn't start working consistently until I was like 17, 18, is that I did make all of those mistakes early on, but I wasn't immune to them. You know what I mean? I wasn't immune to taking things very personally. And I think most people I know who have gotten to the point of maybe perhaps taking things less personally and being able to let them go and less reliant on those external factors to identify you, they also went through the period of making those mistakes, taking things way too personally, and eventually it just becomes kind of exhausting. And for me, it was like, I couldn't stay in this industry and in this job if I kept up with those mental patterns of blaming myself for everything. But it was hard. It took a while. I'm still not entirely immune to it. But, you know, I think really when in doubt, I just try and really look at the facts of things and ask myself if the thoughts I'm thinking are, I mean, are they based in fact? Like, are they true? Or am I just spinning a narrative in my head to fit the conspiracies I have and to fit, like, I don't know. I don't remember if there's a negative term for the term confirmation bias, but it basically is confirmation bias, right? Like, you're seeking out things to confirm the personal and mental conspiracies you have in your head that say that kind of maybe the world is out to get you, or you're the curse of projects and that's why they're not doing well. And I think it just comes down to, you know, you really need to get real with yourself. Is that really true? Like, how much control did I have over the outcome of this? As actors, there is so much out of our control, and there are so many factors that contribute to a project doing well or booking a job. Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully, you know, as actors continue to work in the industry, they just learn more and more how little is in their control and how, unfortunately, a lot of the time, talent and hard work doesn't correlate with the results you want, but it will pay off eventually. I do think that if you work really hard, you will find your pocket or niche in the industry, whether it's your own self-made pocket or other people hiring you. But I think it's really like getting real with yourself and asking yourself, is this true? Or is this my self-spun narrative? You know, and this has not been an easy place for me to come to. Like, I've been in therapy for years. I needed the assistance of therapy and really good friends who are very grounded, a lot of whom are older than me. So they kind of have their priorities really well in check. And that becomes contagious if you surround yourself with the right people, you know, but it's hard. It's much easier said than done. And I think it's also a kind of fake it till you make it type of thing, which is just trying to let it go. And, you know, it's true. Like, I do think that combined with just getting really introspective and really trying to be as honest with yourself as possible, I think the combination of that will eventually inevitably lead to maybe being a bit more, I don't know, less harsh on yourself.
Yeah, you used a really brilliant word to describe the narratives that we use in Weave Stories, which was conspiracies, which is true because, you know, we come up with a conspiracy because our brain needs to connect two things that are seemingly unrelated. And so we have to grout those tiles. And often we will do that with whatever our default settings are. And if we hate ourselves, then it's, that happened because I'm a piece of shit. And of course, that's I always do. Or that happened because the world is out to get me. Or that happened.
Right.
And so that what you're saying about, is this true? I read, I don't know, it might have been on like the mindfulness subreddit or something, but it was about one way that someone found to combat that very thing you're talking about was to ask the question, who told me this?
Right.
You know, it's like if you go, oh, well, you know, this probably didn't work out because that person, like, who told you that? Well, no one actually told me that. Okay, well, then you don't know if it's true. And that helped kind of dissipate, you know, that kind of rabbit hole of that shame spiral and that self-loathing spiral. Because if you can't confirm in your head, like, oh, yeah, no one told me that.
Right.
Sometimes help break that pattern.
Yeah, exactly. Very often there's no evidence to support some of the mental and personal conspiracies we have floating around our head that we think, you know, in terms of the world working against us, but also in terms of our placement in the world and in the business, and, you know, telling ourselves that this keeps happening to me because I am, you know, the industry is very triggering of insecurities, right? So I think whatever your insecurity is, it's similar to like when you don't get a job or when you get broken up with, you're like, okay, they broke up with me because of this, which right. isn't necessarily true, but you project because it's so triggering of insecurities.
Yeah.
So I think you just have to get good at kind of recognizing what your insecurities are, what your triggers are. And just, there's this teacher who I've listened to a lot in interviews, but she's a writer and I think that her books would be deemed kind of in the self-help category, but her name's Byron Katie. Mm-hmm. And her main thing is that she talks to her clients a lot about, and she talks a lot about in interviews, is just the simple act of asking yourself, you know, can I really say that this is true? Do I have the evidence and facts to back this up? And I think more often than not, especially with the mind games we play with ourselves and how negative we can be and harsh on ourselves, we usually don't have evidence to support those thoughts, you know?
No, not at all. And it's, you know, I saw, I just happened upon this YouTube clip. It was Eckhart Tolle, who basically just sits on stage like Yoda and just and he said something that was so impactful to me about, he said, I'm not going to attempt to do his accent, but he said, thoughts are entities.
Yes.
And they feed on your attention, and that's what they do. So when you have a thought and you give it a little bit of attention, it gobbles a little bit and it gets big. I'm paraphrasing. It gets bigger and bigger. And then before you know it, this one little thought turns into, you know, oh, my life is worthless and I can't, because it gets bigger and grows. And so that's where the mindfulness comes in, of sort of acknowledging like, okay, I'm having this thought.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pay attention to it.
Exactly.
And it will move on. And it, just even thinking about thoughts as their own individual entity, mm-hmm. and need to survive, a survival instinct on their own, was paradigm shifting for me, because mm-hmm. it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. And it's, you know, Eckhart Tolle talks about this a lot. It's kind of, and this is, you know, I'm still striving to do this. Sometimes it works, sometimes it just doesn't. But trying to be a witness to your thoughts and looking at them as entities that are separate from you. You know, I think he says, and a lot of other authors and kind of self-help, I don't want to call him a guru, but, you know, like people of his kind say this, that your thoughts are not you. And that's another thing that's just like, to implement that is really difficult, but the occasional reminder of that is important. And it's so funny, actually, because I was reading The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle when we were shooting season one of The Boys, and I loved it. It made a profound impact on me. And it's really, you know, and what he says about how if you're anxious, you're too stuck in the future. And if you're depressed, you're too stuck in the past. And that rang so true for me. And I was reading his book, and it was really enhancing my ability to be present. And it was really, you know, kind of the way, like, I don't know, meditation or antidepressants can just make you, can elevate your spirits. That's how much this book did for while I was reading it. And to the degree that it for a moment, I had to drop the book until I finished filming because it hindered my acting a little bit, which might be just very individual to me, but it made me so kind of at peace with the present. And especially towards the end of season one, I have to be crying a lot, okay? And I was having, and I've never had trouble doing this, I was having trouble crying on set. Because I had Eckhart Tolle in my head saying, well, you need to ask yourself, is there anything wrong right now? Is there anything really wrong? And if there's anything wrong.
Don't get healthy yet. Don't get healthy yet. I'm a little broken to do this.
Totally. Yes. And it was like, you know, he says, if there's something wrong and you can control it, fix it. If you can't fix it, embrace it. And I was like, fuck Eckhart. You're helping me too much. He was talking to me in my head, and I had to cry, and I couldn't get there because I just felt so at peace. So it's a testament to the book. And I tell people, you know, who, let's say they want to do a digital detox, they want to be present, or they just want an overall, like, I don't know, spiritual car wash, I say, read that book. But it was just so funny because it was so powerful to me that it literally hindered my ability to cry on set.
That's so interesting.
It made me feel so at peace for a moment.
That's great. I mean, it is that, it's that great thing. And I wonder about this a lot of time too, where I think like, oh, if I felt, you know, if I were less ambitious, you know, if I were more fulfilled, if I'm more, if I become more fulfilled or I am more fulfilled, and then I don't work as hard, then I don't achieve as much. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times I would just sort of stop there.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I go, well, yeah, but isn't the goal to be happy? It's like, it's not to chase happiness like it's some kind of a drug.
Right.
The idea is to be happy in the moment. And if you don't need to do all that other stuff, but you lead a happy and balanced life and you're happy,
yeah,
and your significant other is happy and healthy, and
yeah,
what else do you, like,
truly,
it's fun to do. It's fun to work. Mm-hmm. It's fun to, but to do it because it's joyful and not because, yes, you're trying to fill a hole, or not because you,
yes,
need to define you because you have a low self-esteem and you want to be, you know, and
yes,
that's such an, it's just such an interesting, the more you focus on the actual present, like you're saying, it's like, mm-hmm, a lot of the other stuff just falls away. And it's like, yeah, mm-hmm, I think this is how we were meant to feel.
I think so. And it's really hard to be present and not be, you know, I think if you have that ambition in you, you're always going to have it to a certain extent, I believe. I don't think you can totally, I mean, and I think it's a good thing. You know, I think you can balance, hopefully, that's what I'm trying to do, balance, you know, being present with ambitions so that they kind of are able to exist simultaneously, so that you're fulfilled, but you're motivated to work. But that balance is really hard to strike because, you know, I will read literature like The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, and I'll try to have those really healthy thoughts. And some days it works, some days it doesn't. Some days I am just thinking about the future and what's next. But I think the more you just kind of consume that type of literature or just listen to podcasts that involve people who kind of speak that way, through osmosis, you start to maybe perhaps be able to practice it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But the balance is hard to strike, especially if you're an innately ambitious person. It's hard, you know, yeah, it's hard to kick that constant kind of obsession with the future, which I still have. And I have now more than ever because quarantine's kind of uncomfortable and yeah, actors aren't working as much. And like, I'm not working till January. And I hate this feeling of being in quarantine. And I've never felt this way where I just want to fast forward my life to January.
Right.
And I hate that. And I am trying my best to kind of fight against that and be present. But right now it's better to practice that than any time before, because so many of us are uncomfortable with staying present given what's going on in the world and given the dormancy of things, you know, because you're lucky because you can talk to people and people are home and you know, a lot of us are able to tap into creative outlets we normally can't. But at the same time, like, I'm desperate to be back on set.
Sure.
I'm desperate for life to resume. So I am struggling with the presence thing now, but I think awareness and acknowledgement of the need for it in your life is the first step, right? And yeah, then,
well, yeah, and you also know it's just a process. Like, some days, yeah, you feel grounded and other days you know you don't, but you also know, like, well, that's just part of it. And tomorrow I could feel fine again. And January will be here before you know. It's already August.
Totally. I know.
I was saying to my wife that, I go, you know, yes, this is a horrible circumstance that the world is in. The mm-hmm. little gift of it has been, we've gotten to spend all this time together.
Yes.
That we never would have. We would have been running around a million directions. And
yeah,
that's been so wonderful. And I know that when the world resumes, you know, and it will, and we all get busy again, I know mm-hmm. that there will be times when I go, you know, I really loved those days where we just mm-hmm. movies all day and got, I mean, again, totally. We're very fortunate that we're able to do this and I understand
right.
it well, but you know, I just miss the simplicity of
yes.
hanging out with my wife and walking the dog. I just,
yes.
and I think those are the life moments mm-hmm. that you really remember more than
oh,
the ambition
yeah.
moments, which burn away like rocket fuel, you know, it's like, you know,
yes.
ambition's neutral, but if you let it consume you, then it's just like, it's never enough. No thing is ever
totally. Enough. Totally. And I think that's what quarantine has taught a lot of people, especially myself, which is that like, okay, without work and productivity and just doing, who am I? And in reality, it really is just about, at least for me, and I think a lot of people have had the same revelation who I've spoken to in terms of some close friends of mine, it really is just about the friendships and relationships. And that's been subtracted from our lives during this time. We're able to FaceTime, we're able to, and I've done some outdoor safe hangouts with people, and I have not been totally alone throughout this, but the subtraction of that has meant more to me than the subtraction of work. And it just kind of made me realize, oh, it kind of clarified priorities, and that in a really accelerated way. Like when life becomes simple and you're just home every day and there's nothing to do, what are the most important things? And I think for most of us, I would say a lot of people kind of get to this point. I think that's why people have families. And I think that's why, but it's about the relationships. Like it's about, you know, the romantic and the platonic ones. Yeah. And, that has definitely been it's been a nice revelation to have, because at 26, I'm kind of in the limbo period between still being, you know, feeling like I'm too young to have a family, but that is floating like around eventually, but I have friends here who are like my chosen family, and, you know, I have a dude, and those are kind of where those matter more than showing up to set. Yeah. And quarantine has clarified that. And that's been really, you know, it's been a really dark period, but there are certainly the benefits that have been most common that I've been hearing about are A, the clarification of priorities that people get from this time of stillness, and B, like families being together for the first time in years. Like I was talking to a friend who is having dinner with his college age kids every night for like 4 months, and he's never done that in his entire life, you know?
It's so funny to hear that. It's like, I said to Lydia, like, I don't think I haven't eaten home this much since like high school, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and it's great. Like there's, I understand the sort of like mealtime and you feed the dog and now we're eating and we're kind of catching up and we're, you know, it's about the connection. And you remember anytime you've ever taken a trip with friends or had a really great hangout with friends, that feeds you so much more than like, time I almost killed myself getting to a thing across the country.
Totally.
Work, you know?
So yeah.
It's just balance. Everything's balance. I know it's like some ambition's good, but to be consumed isn't great. Do you have, are there any, besides interior design, are there particular hobbies that you have? Are there other things that you've cultivated during this that you had never really had time to focus on before?
You know, what I've been doing a lot throughout, so because I grew up in New York City and I was often, like I've always spent time in urban environments, I started doing, and because we can't really travel at all safely during quarantine, which I travel a lot, like for work, but also for pleasure.
Yeah.
I started to camp a lot during quarantine and go up to like Northern California and just figure out kind of creative ways to get out of LA and take weekends or weeks away. Mm-hmm. And I gotta be honest, like I had never, like I'm a New York City kid and I had never, I love nature, always have, but camping, I had never done before. And one of my best friends got a camper van. And so we've been going up religiously all the time to Northern California and hiking, and he surfs and we'll go to Big Sur. And so that has been really, really nice. Yeah. And has been, you know, because we're camping, you're able to do it under very safe circumstances.
Yes.
And it's been really essential because being in my apartment for too long and not being able to get away at least a little bit can kind of shrink my perspective. So that's been great. Mm-hmm. So I've taking up camping and also like learning about how self-sufficient we are when we're able to go camping or go camper vanning is really fun. So I've done that. I mean, like, I've just been cooking loads, which is the cliche of, you know, I haven't done the sourdough kit, so I don't fall totally into the cliche of quarantine. And then I just, like, it's just been, to be honest with you, like, a lot of time spent with my dog, a lot of time spent reading, which I normally do, but this is just, like, reading, taking an afternoon to just read is foreign to me. Unless it's like a weekend, I don't do that anymore. So I think I've read about 5 books so far in quarantine. And just watching old movies that I'd never watched before, and that when I would tell people I hadn't seen them, I would get gasps in the room. So I kind of took it upon myself to watch some movies. And it's funny because I watched so many movies from like 60s, 70s, 80s, which I think are like the best eras for filmmaking. And then I filled my quota, and then I just started watching mindless things. But lots of old movies, lots of camping, lots of cooking. I wish I was one of those people who had taken up a new language, but I'm not. I haven't done the Rosetta Stone yet.
I did it.
You did it?
I did it before. I was doing it before quarantine because we went to Italy in 2019. And I started Italian in college. So I'm like, I'll pick it up again. And we have some. And so I did, you know, I did. And then we just, and I thought I was doing great. And then we just watched an Italian horror series on Netflix called Curran. C-U-R-O-N, Curran. And I was like, I had to read all the fucking subtitles. And I was so discouraged. Oh, I'm like, because it's, you know, when people start talking natively, they don't speak so fast. They speak colloquially.
Yeah.
And every region is a little bit different. And I would pick up stuff and then go, God,
I've been doing this for like 2 years.
Why didn't I?
I know. That's what happened to me. Like when I was, because I got to the point, unfortunately, I'm definitely not still there, but I got to the point of being nearly fluent in Spanish. But then I would go to Spain, where I went a few times, and people would just converse, and they're just so fast and so effortless. And it was such a bummer because, like you said, when you're in class, it's just different. It's the way you speak and you think you're doing so well. And then it just means when we can, you've got to go back to Italy and spend some time.
I would love to at some point. I really would. I did try to experiment with a little brain hack, which is when someone's speaking to you or when you're speaking, it's coming from a different part of your brain than when you speak natively because you just associate words with things in your own language. So I started trying to imagine that Italian words were synonyms for objects.
Right. Interesting. And
clearly it didn't work.
The people that I know who are like truly, truly bilingual, my mom included, like she lived in Paris for a little bit. She speaks French. I find that like you either need to grow up with the language or visit a native country for the language a lot.
And just live there for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, was your visit to Italy, did it catalyze the desire to like go back?
Oh, totally. And, yeah. Because we were only there 3 weeks. We were there for 2 weeks and we went to Paris and we went to London. But there was so much of Italy that we didn't get to see.
Yeah.
And it's regionally, it's also different. And yeah, we're dying.
It's
we're
so beautiful.
It's incredible. It's
so beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It will be nice when, you know, things get better. Things like going on a trip to Italy are going to seem even more magical. Like just the little things that we used to be able to do, no, at least momentarily, we will not be able to take them for granted.
Sitting inside a cafe right now, and that's a funny thing about priorities. It's like, you know, oh my God, I wish we could go to Italy. Well, let me shrink this down. I wish I could just go to that cafe I had breakfast at every morning. We can't go there now.
Yes,
and so,
totally.
Does change all change your perspective, but I don't want to take up too much of your time as we're wrapping this out. You know, what do you obviously with this business, it's good to be present. Like some planning is good to sort of look to some. Are there other types of things that you want to do? Do you want to produce? Do you want to direct? Are you writing? Is there anything else, or are you pretty firmly because you're gonna. You're going to act as long as you want to. You're great in the DeLorean movie, by the way, too.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, love that. So is there anything else? Is there a longer-term career trajectory that you would like to branch into?
Yeah, you know what? I'm sure I could change my mind on this in terms of directing and writing. Those two things, writing doesn't seem to be my forte. Directing, I don't have the desire to do it yet, but that's things are always changing, right? I could be in a totally different place in 10 years, but I am desperate to produce especially because all I do is read books and listen to the news and listen to podcasts and NPR and consume content that I know would just make such good movies that I would love to be a part of the process of producing and have my hand in the process of making film or TV more and have a little bit more control over it. Because while it's kind of maybe liberating and relieving at times to not have control because the pressure is not on you, at the same time, like, the reason why I got into this business is because I just love movies. That's it. It just was that. Horror was like my first favorite genre as a child, by the way. And I know you're a horror.
Wife is even more than I am. Like, my wife. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, love. But I would love to produce. I would love to be responsible for getting something going from ground zero to being made into an actual palpable thing and be involved with kind of shaping the story of it and seeking out good material that, you know, I don't know, highlight stories and characters and humans that are a little bit unconventional that we're not often exposed to, but it would be producing. I would love to.
Can I give you an idea without it sounding too obnoxious? Mm-hmm. And
please.
This is none of my business and I don't want to be presumptuous, but in the next 4 months, you just jot down some ideas or anything that you come across, or even just put on your subconscious radar for any stories that you think, because what I envision is ultimately going to happen. Maybe this has already happened, so I apologize if I'm behind the curve. But The Boys is such a great show, and you've said your career is really exploding. Mm. Someone's going to come to you and say, like, hey, we want to give you your own thing. What do you want to do? Wow. And if you have a couple ideas to produce, you can package in, like, I'll star in this thing, but I want a production deal, and I want to produce things. If you have that ready to go, even if it's not fully fleshed out,
And I'm already ahead of the curve.
You're already ahead of the curve, and it's sort of a preparation meeting opportunity idea. So I don't mean to be rude or presumptuous.
No, that's actually really, it's good to hear that, because I do kind of operate often from a standpoint of listening to things and reading things and thinking, like, okay, what could make a good story and how could I jump in from the beginning as a producer? But I'd say that it's been a few years kind of operating, and that has been, that's turned down a little bit in terms of, like, I haven't been thinking about it as much. And it's really good to be reminded of that, because it's honestly one of the reasons why I read incessantly. Mm-hmm. And there have been so many moments where I've reached out to, you know, my agency or my reps, and I've said, what's the deal with the rights on this? But you're so right. And I need to kind of, because we have the ability to do these things right now, we have time on our hands. It's a good reminder to kind of keep consuming content with that lens and those ears. So you're right. It's a good reminder.
Even just thinking that way, I think it helps. It just kind of opens your eyes to the opportunity and manifest those things. And I don't know, it's just you have you're so well balanced. I'm so blown away. I wish I had that much wisdom when I was 26. And it seems so obvious to me that you're going to do such wonderful things, and you are doing wonderful things. And it's just been such an absolute joy talking to you. I really I'm excited for season 2 of The Boys. Mm-hmm. When does that premiere?
September 4th is when it comes out. So it's a month from, it's a month from today, but this is going to come out not when we're recording it. So it's September 4th.
Great.
And, you know, I hesitate to say this because I kind of want let things to speak for themselves, but I think I think we topped season 1 for sure, in terms of shock value and even quality. So I'm excited for people to see it. And that's really lovely of you to say. And I also just adore the work you do, and I adore your podcast. Oh, thank you. And I just like that you're just having very, you know, intimate conversations with creatives, and we get to kind of peek behind the curtain that we don't normally get to do with, you know, the former versions of interviewing, which were like talk shows. And, you know, I love these long format interviews. And I really dig it.
I appreciate that. It's for me, I just love connecting with people, and I love the podcast to sort of be like, oh, I met an interesting person. We had coffee for an hour and this is what we talked about. You already said so many things that I want to go back and listen to, because they're such sort of wisdom life balance things. And for me, that's the joy of the podcast, is sort of, wow, what a great point to learn. Mm-hmm. So thank you for teaching me some great stuff in this last hour. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah. I'm glad I could.
All right. Well, please stay safe and stay healthy. And anytime you're invited, anytime you want to come on, and I'm sure I'll see you at Comic-Con next year.
Yes. Yes, I would love to. And next time we'll go down the rabbit hole of horror movies and nerding out over that. That's what we have.
Just real quick, favorite horror movie. What's your favorite horror movie?
Oh God, I really liked all the original Japanese ones, the original, like The Ring and The Grudge and The Audition and Mother. But then honestly, that category, I would do like a binge of those on a marathon day. But my favorite of all time is The Shining. Like that to me is just like old school. I love a lot of sci-fi horror, but if I had to pick one, The Shining.
Fantastic.
That's my, and the Blair Witch Project maybe second, but I fucking love The Shining.
I hope you get to meet my wife at some point, because she has a laundry list of, you know, her favorite Scandinavian horror, her favorite Korean horror, her favorite, you know, there's a lot of great Irish horror right now too.
Oh, and yeah.
She's very granular with it. And I feel like y'all would have a lot to talk about. So hopefully you get to meet someday and nerd out.
Yes. Yep. I would love that. Yeah.
All right, Erin, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Stay safe.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.